Many have seen similarities between the firing of FBI Director James Comey and what happened during President Nixon's tenure. And so for our bonus podcast this week, we will revisit an interview I did with Nixon's White House counsel, John W. Dean, one of the last major surviving figures of Watergate. We will take a look at the project to digitize and transcribe the tapes made in the Oval Office when Nixon was president and what they reveal about him and his presidency, and also my conversation with James Rustin Jr., who helped prepare TV personality David Frost for a 1977 series of interviews with Nixon 3 years after his resignation. Enjoy.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I began by telling the president that there was a cancer growing on the presidency, and that if the cancer was not removed, the president himself would be killed by it. I also told him that it was important that this cancer be removed immediately because it was growing more deadly every day.
That's former White House counsel John Dean testifying about a conversation he'd had with President Nixon in March 1973 about the Watergate scandal. Mr. Dean eventually became a critic of the Nixon administration, but still went to prison for his role in the break-in and cover-up. Now, 4 decades later, after he has spent years examining thousands of hours of tapes from the Nixon archives, many of them previously unheard, John Dean has written The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. It's a comprehensive catalog of the Nixon White House as it was consumed and eventually destroyed by Watergate. It's published by Viking, and I'm very pleased to welcome John Dean back to our show today.
Thank you.
In the preface, you say that you are telling Richard Nixon's Watergate story. Why do you think no one else has told the story from Nixon's point of view?
Well, it's not really from his point of view. What I've done is I started with the premise of asking myself, how could somebody as intelligent as Nixon and as politically savvy make the mess of his presidency he made? And he did a good job. And I couldn't understand it. And I thought, maybe by looking at selective tapes and maybe transcribing a few more, I can get the answer to that. What happened in the long run is I had to transcribe everything to follow it day to day to day. And no one had done that. It reveals a lot of new information about what he did and why he did it. And it was something, had I known the size and dimensions of the task, I wouldn't have undertaken it.
But you also write that in listening to the tapes, you're often able to hear words and phrases others do not because of your familiarity with the players and the subject matter.
That's true.
In previous transcriptions, things sometimes were misheard.
Well, what happened is I was able to work with digital copies, which, as you know, in this digital era, we can do things with sound. It doesn't necessarily keep the voice accurate, but you can take words apart and you can play at different speeds. You can use different software. So I was able to tease out things that others weren't that tried it earlier with the analog version. So that helped a lot.
And you also knew the way these people talked.
In fact, the classic example is we had information that Mark Felt was a leak, a serious leak. And I got that information, brought it to the White House, and Haldeman reports it to Nixon. Well, when that happened, there was a recording of it, and the early transcripts of it all had Nixon saying at one point in the conversation to Haldeman, "You know what I would do with Felt?" And then he uses an expletive. I hear something very different, and as soon as everybody hears what I hear, they agree with me. And what he really says is, "You know what I would do with Felt, Bob? An ambassadorship." You can take your own imagination to what expletive he happened to use there. That's what he did with Helms. So it was a standard procedure.
But Felt did turn out to be Deep Throat.
He did. Deep Throat was invented after all of that because we didn't know there was a character by that name. But we did know he was a serious leaker.
Of course, you were also on those tapes. Haven't your political views changed a lot since? Was it difficult to listen to the 30-something John Dean of 4 decades ago?
You know, I don't think my political views have changed very much. I've pretty much stayed where I have always been, and which puts me well to the left today. Really, you know, very few things I have changed my thought and my feelings about. But it what it didn't trouble me to listen to the story because I know how the story ends. You, for example, mentioned that, you know, I went to prison. Well, I really didn't go to prison. What happened, I was in the witness protection program for a year and a half. I had two marshals with me 24/7. And when it came time, I had pled guilty to conspiracy to obstruct justice.
A felony.
And when it came time, and the government wanted me incarcerated because it made me a better witness, I just went to a safe house, and I was driven to Washington every day. So while generically you could say he went to prison, and I don't really contest that, it really wasn't. That.
Well, that's the way it's generally written. So well, I always believe the Internet.
I was going to say, the Internet has it, and as I was talking to somebody today, they said, you ought to correct the Internet. I said, well, I'm not a Wikipedia editor, so I'll have to live with it till somebody straightens it out.
But I was thinking about something else you just said, that you would be considered a liberal, at least then. Tom Wicker once wrote a book in which he said that Nixon was the last liberal president.
Well, he today
because of so many of the things, affirmative action and the Environmental Protection Agency, et cetera, all sorts of things that now are under attack from the right are things that he signed the laws or he followed the laws.
Well, you know what I think, Nixon, knowing him, particularly having studied him, spent as much time with him as I did the number of years listening to all these conversations, I think he was something of a political opportunist. He probably would be a Tea Party activist today and trying to lead that movement. So he would have been ahead of the curve on that. But yes, he was the last liberal president in some ways, you know, the creation of EPA. But these were things that he adopted that his staff, which was very moderate, actually, by and large, other than Pat Buchanan, to a degree, Haldeman was on the right.
But Ehrlichman, too.
Ehrlichman was a very solid supporter of EPA. And that would be even that was fairly progressive at its time. So there was a mixed bag there. And of course, Moynihan was there, and Moynihan may be more libertarian in some regards, but certainly progressive on many, many issues and certainly social issues. So he would embrace different members of his staff, and that gave you a president who today probably would not qualify ever to get a nomination for a Republican nomination.
Let's cut to the chase. Who ordered the break-in at the Watergate?
As best I can tell, it's certainly not Nixon. It certainly didn't come from Nixon.
How soon afterward did he find out?
Well, he finds out the time of the arrest, which is actually the second break-in. And what's ironic is that had the burglars not been arrested at the DNC on June 17th, which was not their true mission that night. They were really going to McGovern's headquarters. And as I point out in the book, you can trace from one of the recorded conversations between Haldeman and Nixon where he tells Haldeman to change or to get a plant. He uses PLANT, a plant, in the McGovern headquarters. Now, does that mean electronic surveillance? Probably not. Probably meant somebody, a secretary, a chauffeur, an intern, something like that. But given Gordon Liddy's disposition to stretch anything he was told to do, it would have been the beginning. And what Haldeman does is he tells his aide, Gordon Strawn, to have Liddy change his capacity from Muskie to McGovern. That's really where they're going the night of the 17th. They're going into McGovern's headquarters. Had they been arrested in McGovern's headquarters, you could trace Watergate right back to Richard Nixon. You can't do that with the break-in at the DNC.
Well, we know that Nixon had ordered break-ins at the Brookings Institution after the release of the Pentagon Papers.
I happen to be the person who stopped that, as it might be. I got wind of that, and I thought they were insane. And flew to California and got them to cancel that particular exercise.
Hadn't you helped recruit G. Gordon Liddy?
Well, you know, that's interesting. I did. I was asked to find a general counsel because my office was spending too much time working on legal issues for the reelection committee. And Haldeman instructed me to find somebody I thought was acceptable over there. I went to Bud Krogh and told Krogh that I wanted to have David Young, with whom he worked, come over, and I thought he'd be a good general counsel. He said, I've got somebody better for you, a fellow by the name of Gordon Liddy, who I hadn't met at the time at all. I know now from Krogh, who told me, he said, we were trying to ease Liddy off the staff. They did not tell me at the time that he had been involved in this Ellsberg break-in.
Did they see him as a loose cannon?
They did see him as a loose cannon, and they thought he would be safe there. But nobody told—neither Ehrlichman nor Krogh told anybody what they were sending over there, where they thought somehow he can't get in trouble over there. But the only thing Krogh did was call Magruder and say, this is somebody who needs a lot of supervision. And they immediately parted their way, and he got no supervision.
He should have been given an ambassadorship. John W. Dean is my guest. His latest book, how many books so far?
I think this is 11.
The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. Were you at any of the meetings that led up to the break-in?
Not to the break-in. What I was, when Liddy went over to the reelection committee, I was asked by Magruder to come to a meeting in Mitchell's office where Liddy presents his plan. And they're absurd. I knew that Liddy was not selling anything. I knew Mitchell well enough. That's why I was there, because Magruder was still trying to figure out what he was working for. This happened in the Attorney General's office. And when I realized that Mitchell wasn't buying any of this, I rest easy. And I did come back and tell Haldeman what I'd seen. There's a second meeting where he comes back in with a pared-down plan. I get to that late and hear the same thing and poured cold water all over it and said, listen, this is craziness. You can't talk about these things in the office of the Attorney General. Fortunately, all that stuff is on tape, too. So I'm corroborated in my recollections of how that all came down.
If you had to come up with someone, would it be John Mitchell? Or
mean,
would it be
who ordered the break-in?
Or no. Would it be that G. Gordon Liddy, being given kind of hazy orders, winds up taking it upon himself?
There's little doubt in my mind how it did happen. Here's what happens. Liddy's plans are approved by Mitchell in Florida at a third meeting. And part of the plans call for an entry into the Watergate. This is something he has discussed with Magruder. Magruder thinks it's fine, thinks it's a good idea, thinks they should try to take some photographs, get anything they can on Larry O'Brien, fish around for his finances and see what they can find out that can be embarrassing. And so he has that general assignment. He does it. And it's a total flop. They don't even get into O'Brien's office. You know, Liddy sort of portrays himself as this James Bond type character when he really is, the record shows, isn't even in the Maxwell Smart capabilities.
He did have a radio talk show for many years. I don't know what that says about talk show hosts.
That they should stay out of break-ins, I think. But anyway, how's he get in there? What happens is, as a result of the material he's getting out of the DNC, that's coming back to Magruder. Magruder sharing it with Mitchell. Mitchell thinks it's junk, and he picks up the phone. And this, Jeb has said this to me at the time when I'm trying to figure out what had happened. He has now said it. He said it under oath. He's been very consistent on this. He said, I didn't know there was going to be a break-in at the DNC the second time. Had no idea. I knew they were getting junk out of there. I was delighted when I saw John Mitchell pick up the phone and ream out Gordon Liddy, who I thought was a jerk. And Liddy took it upon himself to go back in the night they were to go into McGovern's headquarters and fix the bug and figure out where Larry O'Brien's office was. And I don't think Liddy understood until long after he wrote his own book that they had never gotten to Larry O'Brien's office.
Nixon's taping system led to his resignation, but it also gave the public a rare glimpse into the psyche of an executive. It isn't always pretty, but in that sense, wasn't it a gift?
Well, the tapes are, as Bob Woodward once said, and Bob Woodward, who I spoke with, who interviewed me for C-SPAN on this 2 days ago, He is stunned with the new material I found. You had about 600 tapes that nobody had ever listened to before, and then having better equipment to hear what I was able to hear, it really creates a different story. It fills it in, and there's more logic to the way it happens.
So now he's going to do a revised edition of All the President's Men.
He doesn't have to, because, you know, his story really isn't in the Oval Office.
My guest is John W. Dean. His latest book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It, it is published by Viking, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with John W. Dean, who was legal counsel to President Nixon during the Watergate scandal. His latest book is called The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. It's published by Viking. And looking at many of these conversations, nearly everyone in the Nixon White House comes across as almost pathological. Was this specific to the people in Nixon's orbit, or does power on that level make everyone a little crazy?
I'm not sure the answer to that. I don't think, you know, I didn't see them that way at that time. I didn't see them behind closed doors, as this book lets you do, because it's based on their these very private recordings that nobody knows are being made.
Nixon knew they were being made.
You know,
do you think he ever was working to the tape, or did he forget?
There are instances where it's clear that Nixon knows he's recording and is doing it very consciously and making a record. The person who seems most conscious is the only other person who knew about it was Bob Haldeman. In fact, when it really gets to the crunch in the later part of this story that I reveal, Haldeman won't talk to the president about some very sensitive things he wanted to discuss. He says, let's go to the Lincoln sitting room where there's only a telephone recording. And, you know, he's conscious of it. Ehrlichman doesn't know about it. Kissinger doesn't know about it. I suspect it late. In fact, that suspicion results in it being revealed. But no one really knows. So these are about as candid as you can get. And Nixon, because it's voice activated, he's not turning it on. He forgets. He forgets all the time.
And we get a real insight into his psyche on these tapes. And one from July 1972, he describes a dream to H.R. Haldeman and says, "I have a feeling Watergate's going to be a nasty issue, but I can't believe, maybe I'm whistling in the dark, but I can't believe that they can tie it to me." Was he in denial?
Very prescient is what he was. He had some sort of vision of where this could go. Very interesting. They're walking out of the office when this happens, and there's a little exchange, and he's obviously concerned. He just kind of pauses and said, "You know, I had this vision, this dream." And Haldeman says, sort of, you know, "Don't worry, I don't think that's going to happen," kind of approach.
The cartoon Nixon is paranoid, sweaty, insecure, uncomfortable in his own skin. Was that at all like the Nixon you knew?
No. In fact, one of the interesting things the tapes reveal is that Nixon is a different person with different members of his staff and different people who come in and visit. No question that Chuck Colson brought the darkest side of him out. Haldeman was close. But on the other side, when I'm queuing these up, to listen to the parts of the conversations I want to hear. There were, for example, conversations with his daughters. Most of the personal stuff is withdrawn, but occasionally, because it is government business related, it really didn't fit the criteria of being personal, so these were left in. And these are lovely conversations. He has a nice daughter-father relationship with both girls. Same with his wife. For example, in January 73, when he thinks he's got finally got a peace accord for the battle with the Vietnam War, one of the first persons he wants to talk to is his wife, Pat, and they have a really nice conversation. I'm sure his family was just stunned to hear this personality that is so prevalent on so many of these conversations.
Well, what comes across is that no matter what he achieved, Nixon always felt kind of inferior or vulnerable on some level.
For sure. The more he succeeds, the more revengeful he gets. This is when he's going to turn on his enemies. When things are going well, that's when he calls people in and say, "Now we're going to get them." And he has his list. I would go from the apple of his eye to his most bitter enemy. Another ironic
because,
thing about...
Because you want to testify.
Well, I told them I was going to break rank, and that caused serious concern. I was very open. This wasn't something I just sort of snuck off and did. I revealed to them what I was going to do because I really thought the cover-up had to end. And I said I felt by breaking rank and going to the prosecutors that Haldeman and Ehrlichman would follow me. I thought they would do the right thing. That was one of the great disappointments to me, that men who I had some respect for and thought really would protect the presidency. In fact, Ehrlichman talks about it. You know, maybe we should think in terms of what this office is rather than any personal concerns we have. But he dismisses that when the short strokes are being taken.
Well, it must have been obvious at a certain point that this could lead to impeachment and even worse.
Well, I did. I mean, I think I'm the first one who actually mentions it to Nixon. But Ehrlichman is very conscious of this. At one point, he tells him, you know, I've analyzed this and I realize you can't be prosecuted for any of this. As president, it looks to me, and this is pretty much law now, maybe lure more than law, because the Department of Justice has never confronted the issue square on, but there are a number of very sophisticated memos that came up and got reduced to writing during the Agnew matter, where Agnew was claiming he was immune from prosecution. Well, that's not true, but they conceded the president was probably and should be immune from prosecution.
So Gerald Ford did not have to pardon him?
Oh, no. That was purely his option to and decision. And
but, I mean, would it have mattered if he hadn't? Could Nixon have been tried?
Oh, absolutely, when he left the office, no longer with the mantle of the presidency.
So he might have gone to prison, actually.
And he has some sort of really kind of sick jokes about it, about how Gandhi went to prison and did some beautiful writing, and maybe he will write in prison.
One of your books is Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush. Do you still think that's true after listening to these tapes?
Understand the basis of that. That was based on two things. One was the secrecy was far worse with the Bush administration, principally through Dick Cheney's efforts, than it was in the Nixon administration. And the other thing is, I don't think in Richard Nixon's darkest moment he would have used torture as a technique. And I think that's pretty serious stuff.
You note that he believed that he'd been bugged during previous campaigns and that if he could make the fact that it had been done to him an issue, it would put the Watergate break-in in context. Was that his way of rationalizing dirty tricks? Well, somebody did it to me, so I can do it to them?
You've got two things there. The answer is yes to both, but let me separate them. His thinking that he had been bugged in 68, he raises it periodically, and he thinks this is his great ace that he can pull out and tell the Democrats, listen, you raise this Watergate investigation, I'm just going to raise the fact that I was told by J. Edgar Hoover that Lyndon Johnson bugged me, and it was much more serious than what happened with this bungled burglary at the DNC. Well, that was just not realistic. It wasn't going to influence anything. In fact, it turns out it wasn't even true. They traced telephone calls from the vice president's plane when he was landed in New Mexico, but no bugs were actually placed on him during the campaign. Now, the second part of your question is, did he think because other presidents, in essence, had done something that he could do it? Absolutely. He refers to this all the time. He thinks what everybody from FDR to JFK to LBJ, because they had done it, he should do it. Now, the difference, though, is very, very stark. It was an exception to the rule with prior presidents, where it becomes standard procedure with Nixon, and he thinks it's a procedure he can employ, and that's a big difference.
And later, people like Cheney and Rumsfeld talked about the imperial presidency as something that they actually promoted while they were working for Nixon.
Absolutely. They tried to revive the imperial presidency, and Obama is accused of running an imperial presidency. He is not even close to the league.
But he's a Democrat.
I told my editor the other day, since I've been here in New York, I said, you know, somebody should send this book to all those Republicans in Congress who are talking about impeaching Obama. This would tell them what the real problems are when you want to think about impeachment.
Well, some people are saying now, anytime you don't like something a president does, you say the word impeachment. It didn't work very well with Bill Clinton.
It's kind of a modified parliamentary vote of no confidence, if you will, because typically they know the Senate is not going to convict and remove, but they're cheapening a very important procedure by what they're doing.
John W. Dean's latest book is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. It's published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Is the title a bit misleading because The Nixon Defense sounds like you're defending Richard Nixon?
Well, actually, the original title was In Defense of Nixon. And I because of that reaction some people had at Viking, I changed it to The Nixon Defense. And the reason what this is, it's an explanation that from day one, from the time of the arrest, Richard Nixon is defending himself, and he has multiple defenses. They evolve, and they get more convoluted, and they get more bogus. He hangs himself on his own defense, and that's why I adopt that title. The subtitle's obvious. That was Howard Baker's question. Regarding the tapes of what, or the tapes do answer the question of what he knew.
And many people believe that one of the most egregious things that was done in his defense was the 18 and a half minute erasure, that gap. You conjecture as to what was on the tape.
Well, I do, because I put a special appendix, because this is, as I see it, largely a media issue, and understandably so. And it became a media issue because Nixon said and pretended like he was cooperating, that he was going to turn over tapes, that he was going to do it voluntarily. And then suddenly tapes start missing. And it culminates with he gives a big speech down in Florida saying, no more problems, I've come clean. And the next day he has to go to court and say, I have an 18 and a half minute gap in one of these key conversations that have been subpoenaed by the prosecutor. June 20th, first day he's back after the Watergate break-ins. And to me, there's just who did it? Well, I give you in a note, because that's where I think it belongs, who could have done it? Who had it at had access to this tape at the right time? I don't know. It's pretty much down to two people in my mind. I'm not going to name them.
Well, most people thought it was his secretary.
But I also, in the appendix, explain Rose could not have done it the way she explains, because we found an expert on these machines who had this. Had he not resigned and this been fully litigated, there's an expert that a foreign machine that was brought in, it will not do it. You cannot do it the way she said, with a foot pedal and pressing the button. The machine is designed not to erase in those circumstances.
Since there is so much incriminating evidence on these tapes, why do you think that 18 and a half minutes had to be erased? You would think that I would have wanted to erase everything.
No, here's exactly why he wanted to erase that 18 and a half minutes. And it just that particular tape was subpoenaed. That's the first part. And that whole week, the first week after the break-in, they start talking about covering up what had happened. He has by the time the gap occurs, he has put his last defense out, which is he knew nothing of a cover-up until after I came in on June 21st and told him there was a cancer on his presidency. So this, if that tape had been produced, in fact, 3 days later, the smoking gun tape is produced, they show he was very involved in a cover-up. So it just blows his defense is what happens.
One of the things that I was unaware of until I read this book was that in September 1972, Nixon tried to infiltrate Senator Ted Kennedy's world by offering him Secret Service protection as a way of getting information about Kennedy fed back to the White House. Did he just want to get some dirt on Kennedy?
Yes.
Did Kennedy turn it down because he suspected?
I don't know. I think Teddy Kennedy was obviously very smart in just saying thank you, but no thank you. And that ended it. In fact, there's an interesting conversation that's in the book about how Haldeman says, well, I'm not quite sure how we do this, how we ask the Secret Service to do this. And Nixon said, well, maybe one of them will just volunteer it to us.
Now, he won the election despite Watergate, at least the fact that we knew that there was a break-in, by a huge landslide. And even though he won overwhelmingly over George McGovern, you say he was in a terrible mood, depressed, and barely able to even pretend he was a winner.
Exactly. And he actually, I was interested to see how he handled that in his memoir, because it was conspicuous to all of us that this man was just in a funk. Here he was at the highest moment of his life. And not happy about it. He speculates it's because the shadow of Watergate was hanging over, that he had this terrible problem.
So he felt 4 years that he was going to be under that shadow.
Yes, indeed.
Well, he was also consulting with Henry Kissinger, who right now is giving advice on Iraq and other things. You write that Kissinger enjoyed bolstering Nixon's darkest thoughts. Did he give him good advice on how to handle the crisis?
I write that because one can read for himself that these are pretty dark thoughts that Henry is sharing and encouraging him to have.
And what kinds of thoughts? Was he suggesting that Nixon get revenge?
Exactly, exactly. And in fact, one of the ones that just of many that pop in my mind.
I gave him a hard interview once. Is he going to get back at me?
I doubt it. But Henry, for example, said to Nixon, he said, you know, you have been so good to the press. They've been so terrible to you. And your biggest fault is you've been too kind to them and not beating them up enough. So that was the typical kind of Kissinger flattery, but was really, as I say, egging him on to even worse.
You testified at the trial of John Mitchell and Maurice Stans that you destroyed two notebooks taken from E. Howard Hunt's safe. What was in them, and why did you shred them?
What happened is they were called Hermes notebooks, and they had lists of names of people that had been involved in the Ellsberg break-in. There were really very little material in them, and it was just a very... As I explain it today, I understand exactly what happened. Is I was in something you call the lost frame. I was in a no-win situation. Here were these. They had been left by mistake. We thought we'd turned everything over to the FBI. And there was just no easy way to explain why somebody had withheld these, and they just had been misfiled in a safe. So I just said, hell, we'll just toss them in the shredder.
At a certain point in the tapes, you hear Haldeman saying to Nixon, really, your only real route is to destroy Dean.
Well, that
Nixon
was one...
also calls you a number of names on the tape. The only FCC-friendly ones are bastard and son of a bitch.
I was going to say, it disintegrates from those, too.
Did they do to discredit you?
Well, they put out a lot of false rumors. Claimed I was lying when I was telling the truth. They did just about anything and everything you can think of using the power of the presidency to try to destroy me as a witness. But fortunately, the truth prevailed. And I, you know, I don't know how it would have turned out without the tapes. But I was very comfortable. While I didn't think I could verbatim repeat my conversations, I certainly remembered the gist of them. My biggest fault, and they nailed me for this a couple times, was the fact that I conflated situations and got some dates wrong, but that's about it.
Have you ever speculated about how Watergate would have played out if it had happened in today's media environment?
Well, you know, that's a good question. There was no Fox News at that point, and Fox probably would have been the big defender, although they have not really been aggressive in defending Nixon. It's hard to find a media outlet that really thinks that Nixon did something right in Watergate. So I'm not sure how it would have played out.
We will be talking more about the Nixon tapes tomorrow, because Luke Nitscher will be here to talk about his book, which covers a quite a different area.
Different area, and they did. He did that book with Doug Brinkley, who is a friend of mine, and I'm sure they've done a good job. And there's no question that the books complement each other. He doesn't deal with Watergate, and he provides transcripts rather than narrative and dialogue, which I have done.
John W. Dean's book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It, is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's been nearly 30 years since the British TV personality David Frost interviewed former President Richard Nixon. Those shows inspired the hit play Frost Nixon, in which James Reston Jr. is a character. He was one of the chief researchers for the interviews and wrote a memoir about his experiences not long after the shows aired. But it hasn't been published until now. The memoir, The Conviction of Richard Nixon, The Untold Story of the Frost-Nixon Interviews, has finally been published by Harmony Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Reston to my program now. Hello.
Hi.
So, first the obvious question. Why have you waited 30 years to publish this?
Well, technically, in 1977, I was David Frost's employee, and with the immense success of those interviews, they were watched after all by something like a third of the American population. It was natural for him to think about doing his own book, and so I deferred to him at that time. Put this manuscript away, taught a course in Nixon. I was then teaching at the University of North Carolina and taught a course, and then got involved in other things and just literally forgot about this until the playwright Peter Morgan was in touch with me a couple years ago.
Did he read your book to get information, to get some details that were necessary for the play?
I think it's pretty obvious when you see the play or read the play and read the book side by side how important this book was to Peter.
Who initially brought you into the interview project?
Well, I had collaborated with Frank Mankiewicz on a book in the early 1970s called Nixon from Whittier to Watergate, Perfectly Clear. And when David Frost came through Washington in 1976 looking for somebody to help him do the research on Watergate, but also to construct an interrogation strategy, I was suggested to him.
Because that's part of what this whole thing is. It's not the same thing as a lawyer asking questions, but you do have to come up with a strategy. And not everybody who's a good researcher is good at developing the evidence of the prosecution of someone, especially someone as clever as Richard Nixon.
Well, you're using the right term there. This wasn't an interview, but it was a prosecution. And it was a unique prosecution in the sense that it was before ultimately 57 million people. But beyond that, this was the one shot history was going to get at a true interrogation of Nixon, no holds barred about the facts of Watergate. There's a one-off thing. And Frost had constructed a network of his own over a period of a year and a half, and so forth. He had hired me something like 9 months beforehand. So it was one person working for 9 months nonstop on this material. So all of those factors were quite rare.
Didn't you actually consult with a group of academics before you decided to take this job?
Well, the issue was, you know, how do you go after this quarry? You know,
it's one thing to gather all the evidence. It's another thing to then use it effectively.
I recently had a picture of myself taken with all of the books that had been produced. I mean, the books from the various government agencies, the House Judiciary Committee on Impeachment, the Irvin Committee hearings, the Special Prosecutor's Office. There was just an immense amount of material to master, but then you master all the facts of Watergate, it can be a blizzard. And so it was a question of how do you boil that blizzard down into a strategy with a set goal at the end of it.
Because you came up with stuff that even the Watergate prosecution hadn't come up with.
Well, they had come up with it, but they hadn't released it and, in a public sort of way. So it was material for a surprise.
What was your impression of David Frost when you first met him?
Well, that was a big question. He was a kind of a mixed bag. He had done some good interviews, but he had done a lot of showbiz kind of stuff. He had a very quick wit and a good sense of humor. All of that was on the positive side of it, but he was certainly not a scholar. And I think that's why he hired me. I was to master all of this and then to bring it together into some sort of a cohesive form for him to use when he went on the set. And the big question mark was, would he ever do his homework? Because he was gallivanting all over the world, and he was in the celebrity pages and so forth all over the place. And
at that time, he was working in Australia doing celebrity interviews, and he was considered a journalistic lightweight. And Nixon dismissed him as such. I think Nixon probably thought this was going to be a slam dunk, to use somebody else's phrase.
Yes. Well, I think there were three reasons why Nixon did this. One was money. I mean, this was an outrageous example of checkbook journalism.
Was that discussed? Was this the implications of that?
It was a very hot issue because the amount of money, $600,000 in 1976, was immense. Plus, there was going to be a proportion of the take of the profit that Nixon would also get. So I think he realized over $1 million.
Did he need that money?
Well, I don't think he needed it so much as that this was part of the Nixon personality and lore, that he was always interested in money, I think. And so that was a factor. He did think that Frost was a lightweight. This would be a walk in the park in which he would not only make a lot of money but rehabilitate his reputation. And he was also at that time working on his memoirs, so this would just be a sort of a video version of his memoirs. I think those were the motivations why he did it.
So you had to come up with a stylistic approach that in formulating the questions for Nixon. And you write that you wanted to avoid allowing Nixon to look presidential. How do you do that, and why was that a real concern for you?
Well, this was 1977, 3 years after he had resigned. He had resigned because he had been driven from office. The House Judiciary Committee had reported out 3 articles of impeachment against him. He certainly would have lost that vote in the House and certainly would have been convicted in the Senate if it had gone forward. He had resigned, the only president in history ever to do that, in disgrace after this horrible smoking gun tape came out. He had then accepted a pardon, and a pardon by its conceptual nature means an acceptance of guilt, a recognition of one's guilt. So this was not a moment at which objective journalism was called for. This was a moment at which guilt was established, and yet if these programs, if he was allowed to look presidential, that guilt could have been called into question. And the American people might have said, hey, wait a minute, maybe we made a mistake here. That would have been a terrible result. So From my standpoint, as the sort of the passion behind David Frost and all of this, the fact that Nixon was being paid this outrageous amount of money and was going to rehabilitate his reputation in the process, that would have been an absolute disgrace.
But you also felt that it was important to confront him on a human level.
Well, I was a lot more interested in that side of it than David Frost was. I thought that the Nixon personality was endlessly fascinating, and that was an area in which we could really make a contribution to history if we could plumb some of the depths of that. Frost rejected that strategy, basically, felt that in the Watergate show particularly, it really had to be a kind of facts and dates interrogation in which the evidence of the tape recordings would be thrown at Nixon and his guilt established, in a sense. So there were really two ultimate goals for this thing. One, he had to be forced, that is to say, dragged into an acknowledgement of his criminality. And then if you could succeed in demonstrating that criminality, then you would hope in your wildest dreams to get some sort of an apology from him.
My guess is James Reston Jr., his book, The Conviction of Richard Nixon, The Untold Story of the Frost-Nixon Interviews. It's published by Harmony Books. There were tensions within the group. John Britt, Frost producer, wanted to throw you off the research team because he didn't like what you were suggesting?
Well, mind you, I was a bit naive. I was coming from academia. I was not used to sort of how the rough and tumble of big corporations or institutions or big productions like this. And I came sort of loaded for bear. You've mentioned that I gathered academics, a psychiatrist, a political scientist, a historian. I gathered these people together before I went into the interviews saying, you know, now what is the highest mark that we can shoot for here in these interviews? And so I came to the group with, you know, armed with a lot of very strong opinions. And I was not shy in expressing them. And some within the team were horrified at this.
Like the human level suggestion.
Right.
There was a 10-page memo, rambling memo, released recently in which President Nixon wrote to his chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, about how people need to see the human side of the president. Some of the things in it, he says, there are such little things, such as the treatment of household staff, the elevator operators, the office staff, the calls that I make to people when they are sick, even though they no longer mean anything to anybody. These are odd thoughts for a man who is president of the United States.
And it's also a scenario. It's also insincere. It's not authentic.
Did you see the human side of Nixon during the interviews?
No, I think we dragged the human side out of him in the Watergate show.
He did invite you to go surfing at the San Clemente complex and then afterward offered to let you take a shower in his house.
Yeah, I thought that was a bit sketchy. I thought that was probably not a good idea.
Why did your team decide on a strategy you called adverse interference? How did that work?
Well, if you assume guilt of your subject rather than you assume innocence, it's really a fairly classic prosecutorial device to put an adverse inference on everything that the subject says because you want him to look like he's lying.
He said that he had been punished enough, I think it's now called the Libby defense. He's entering with a very different sense of what this is all about.
Well, that's as old as the hills, isn't it? For people, particularly political figures who get into criminal processes, and it takes a long time, and it's all publicized and so forth. And at the end, their defenders always say, "Oh, he's suffered enough. You know, just let him go."
But you didn't feel that was the case. You felt that it was necessary for him to suffer a bit more for some kind of cathartic experience for the American public?
Well, I did feel that, yes. I'm a person who comes out of the Vietnam generation and out of the civil rights era before that. And the Vietnam era had been a terrible period, not unlike the Iraq War now. A terrible divisive war in which under Nixon's tutelage some 25,000 people had been killed in the Nixon presidency in the Vietnam War. And so we were moving by 1977 when this happened into an era of binding up the wounds of reconciliation. And we had also, in parallel to that, had the Watergate thing, and that was 2 years of agony. So you had Vietnam and Watergate, and the country was trying to bounce back from these two nightmares. Well, I think, you know, calling Nixon to account for Watergate was part of that reconciliation process.
I'm talking with James Rustin Jr., whose books include Warriors of God, Dogs of God, The Last Apocalypse, Galileo, A Life, the memoir Fragile Innocence, and now a 30-year-old memoir. I suspect you did a little bit of fixing up.
Not for the basic narrative of what happened in 1977. I think that's part of the argument for the book, that it has such a sense of immediacy, that this is not me remembering what happened 30 years ago, but publishing an account, a narrative that was very timely at the moment and then set aside. It's a, kind of like a fairy tale of publishing, actually. I did include a foreword and an afterword that were written in the last year.
And the book is called The Conviction of Richard Nixon, The Untold Story of the Frost-Nixon Interviews, published by Harmony Books. Let's hear a little bit from Richard Nixon talking about Cambodia.
Henry came in one day and he said, you know, I'm not sure that we should have gone into this Cambodian thing. And perhaps now has come the time that we should shorten the time and get out a little sooner. He wasn't seriously considering it, but he said, I think, and he used to always preface it by saying, I must warn you, Mr. President, that the situation that I hear from my colleagues from the colleges and universities is very, very serious. And Cambodia is it could have been a mistake. And then I said, Henry, I said, we've done it. I said, remember Lot's wife. Never look back. I don't know whether Henry'd read the Old Testament or not, but I had. And he got the point. Henry and I often had a little joke between us after that. Whenever he would come in and say, well, I'm not sure we should have done this or that or the other thing, I would say, Henry, remember Lot's wife. And that would end the conversation.
We're back with James Rustin Jr. His latest book is actually 30 years old, but just published, called The Conviction of Richard Nixon, The Untold Story of the Frost-Nixon Interviews, published by Harmony Books. Were you concerned that if your team and David Frost failed, that Richard Nixon would ultimately become rehabilitated in the public's mind?
That was the central worry, and it was a serious question. David Frost may well not have been up to this whole thing, and he gave us plenty of evidence that he was not up to it in the early stages of this thing. He was not doing his homework. He would flit in and out of Washington. He never did any serious interviewing of anybody on his own. To my knowledge, he never really paid attention to this ream of memorandums that I was preparing for him to prepare him for the interviews themselves. And then, you know, these were four 90-minute programs, but they were boiled down from something like 26 or 28 hours of actual taping, and the Watergate thing came towards the end of it. So the early part of it, the domestic policy and foreign policy segments, Nixon was walking all over him, like the clip you just did in Cambodia, where Nixon indeed acts presidential. When he talks about him reading the Old Testament, I seriously doubt that he ever read the Old Testament. One of the people I was secretly talking to through this whole thing was a very fine historian by the name of Fawn Brody, who was doing a biography of Richard Nixon at that time. And she used to talk about Nixon's unnecessary lies. And I would submit that him having read the Old Testament is one of those unnecessary lies.
On the other hand, you did have to allow him to talk about the positive aspects of his presidency as in opening China to the United States after all of those years of keeping it out of world politics, despite the fact that it was the most populous country in the world. Frost wasn't looking at anything, but you were going over hours and hours of transcripts and finding all sorts of stuff. Did it wind up being a cherry-picking kind of thing where you said, well, okay, we'll let that one slide because it's less important than this other one, or we'll never be able to get to it even in, how many hours? You said 28 hours?
Yeah. Right. But you have to understand that Watergate was everything for this project. It really didn't matter what he said about foreign policy or domestic policy. That was kind of a sop to Nixon, that he would be allowed to talk about his great accomplishments.
So you're going to give him those three shows so that you could have the fourth show.
That's right. And my whole thing was the Watergate thing exclusively, pretty much. So, yes, there was this mountain of material there. I don't know how many tape recordings there were, and it was much of those tape recordings were garbage, so that you had to read all the garbage in order to find, you know, the pearls in it. And then once you found the pearls, to figure out, you know, how could they be used effectively.
And you also had to have some sense of how he would respond. When Frost producer John Britt first met with Nixon, he attempted a joke, and Nixon didn't get the joke. That it's hard to interview somebody who has certain gaps in his sensibility.
Well, he was a very strange man, and small talk was not his thing. Much fun is made out of that in the Frost-Nixon play.
Nixon makes fun of himself in that regard in the play.
Yes, he does, and that's accurate. That is well documented. I had times in the kitchen between the actual tapings when we would fall into conversation. It was a painful process.
Politicians often avoid answering questions directly. Did anything make you think that Nixon's performance would be any different?
No, that was the challenge. How to break him out of his studied defenses.
So you had to have some surprises up your sleeve? Is that it?
Was certainly the case. Whether we would be able to was something else again. I mean, this process had been going on for 2 years. There had been 800 reporters focused on it. There had been, you know, all of these various committees. I thought it very unlikely that we'd be able to find anything new.
But you did have these things, and you kept you had them up your sleeve, and Frost knew that when things started getting out of hand, he could just slip them in?
Well,
when did he start taking it seriously?
He really started taking it seriously a week before the Watergate show.
Well, maybe that was the way he had to work.
You could argue that. I mean, the play makes it into a kind of bout of heavyweights. And, you know, they talk about in heavyweight fights about the fighter peaking at the right moment. Frost did peak at the right moment. But on the surprise question, this was some conversations that I discovered between Richard Nixon and Charles Colson, who was a real bad guy in the White House. He was the one who came up with the enemies list and wanted to firebomb the Brookings Institute
a religious leader. He came on the show to talk about his religious conversion.
Yeah, right. Well, I used that, actually, when I went to see him in 1977, saying, you know, he told me about these conversations, and I said, well, now that you've come to Christ and you've been in prison and had your enlightenment, you wouldn't mind sharing these with me. And he said, come back in a week, and put before me at that point sanitized excerpts from these conversations, but not the real thing. And so it was a diversion. But ultimately, I found those transcripts deep, deep in the court file for the H.R. Haldeman trial. And they had never been published. They'd never seen they'd never been in any of the government proceedings. And that placed
Nixon and the Watergate break-in cover 3 days before it was originally thought.
In the initial thing, in the first business day after the break-in itself on June the 20th, when the smoking gun tape, which drove him from office, was 6 days afterwards. So there we had this gold to actually place him in the conspiracy right at the beginning. And because he had this studied defense, he was ready to argue that he didn't know anything until 6 days afterwards. So what I advised Frost to do, and what he did to perfection, was to let Nixon restate his public position and then surprise him and say, well, why did you say 3 days before that? And then there were other Colson tapes that did that.
And you write that when Nixon was presented with this new evidence, you closely watched his face.
Well, you see, this was a trial on television, so the television close-up was everything.
And he had a very expressive face, didn't
he? Oh, magnificent. It was a very mobile, interesting face. And that was part of the drama and part of the entertainment, if you will, of the Nixon interviews, that the body language was so fascinating. Because he started off saying, this is how we're going to do this, Mr. Frost. And he's really the cock of the walk, and he's the one in charge. And then they start into it, and David springs these surprises on him, and the close-up comes in on Richard Nixon, and it's just a totally different body language.
My guess is James Rustin Jr., his latest book is perhaps, I don't know if this is your first book, but one of the first, perhaps, The Conviction of Richard Nixon, The Untold Story of the Frost-Nixon Interviews from Harmony Books. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. There were any number of funny things that happened during the Watergate segment, largely at Nixon's expense. What was it about his response on Senator John Stennis that you found so funny?
And this was actually quite unfair, really, that Senator John Stennis had been proposed by Nixon to listen to some of these tapes for Congress. And they got into this, and David Frost said, but Senator Stennis is deaf, isn't he? And so you're proposing that the one who is going to authenticate these conversations be done by a deaf man. And Nixon would say, but he's a very distinguished senator, and he would go on, but Frost would say, but he can't hear anything. You know, it was really a wildly funny moment in the whole thing. Totally unfair, because I ran into to somebody who knew Senator Stennis several months after that, and they said his hearing is perfectly fine.
But Nixon probably was unaware of that.
Yes, right.
He refused to admit that the 18.5-minute gap on the tape had really been erased.
That had always been his position, but that was the value of the Colson conversation, because the 18.5-minute gap happened also on June the 20th, and therefore it's evidence that was lost. So Nixon could just say, this is what was in the 18.5-minute gap. Nobody would know any different. But then Frost had this other conversation, which was probably more damning than what was on the 18.5 minutes.
Now, you said that the really important one was the Watergate show, but you did have all sorts of dream questions you wanted to ask about Vietnam that never got asked. Was that strategy, or was just Frost didn't want to do them?
Well, I was, I want to use this word carefully, I was sort of thought of as the radical in the group. I had served in the Army for 3 years during Vietnam, and then had been very active in the amnesty movement after that. So I was, and I'd written a lot about Vietnam, so I was quite passionate about that and thought that, you know, he really needed to be interrogated about Vietnam and as he was going to be interrogated about Watergate. But it was not my field. So they got into that, and Nixon was walking all over Frost, and I was horrified and angry about all of this. So sort of in desperation, David said, okay, well, we'll go back to this briefly. Give me your dream questions. And I thought up some dream questions, and of course they were never asked.
Nixon's relationship with Henry Kissinger was often a complicated one, as has been pointed out over the years. The two both needed and disliked each other. Let's play a little clip about what he has to say about that.
Henry, on the other hand, was fascinated first by the celebrity set, and second, he liked being one himself. Not at first, but people would start coming up for his autograph, and he was invited more and more to the Hollywood parties and the rest. And when you go to these parties, and I used to be in that category when I was vice president and even as a senator and congressman, a rather well-known one. And when the Georgetown hostesses have you in, they don't have you there in order to feed you. They have you there in order to for you to entertain their guests with some little tidbit that has happened that day, what Eisenhower said, or what did Dulles say, or what kind of a man is Churchill. Did you really talk to him? Well, anyway, that's Henry. Henry, when he goes to these parties, and he likes parties, I despise them because I've been to so many. I used to like them, but Henry will learn to despise them too after he's been through a few more. But be that as it may, so he goes to a party, and I can see exactly what happened in Canada. He runs into a lady who has a very low opinion of me, and so Henry feels that really he's defending me, and that the way that best to defend is to concede that, he's sort of an odd person, he's an artificial person, and so forth and so on and so on. And the only problem was that he didn't think to turn the microphone off. But on the other hand, I didn't turn it off either in the Oval Office on occasion, so I never held it for that.
One of the funnier moments. And that is also used in the play, Frost.
Yes, it's funny, but it's also the kind of thing that would infuriate me when it was actually happening, because these were minutes that were lost in just sort of idle conversation. He was being paid all this money, and he wasn't to be paid all this money just to sort of remember little stories like that.
On the other hand, they make the final show all that much more powerful. At what point during the interviews do you think that Nixon realized he had lost?
The Watergate interrogation took place over 2 days, actually, and it had been a withering interrogation for the first day, and overall it was a process of grinding him down with the evidence of the tapes and so forth. And we started into the second day, and Nixon looked terrible, and he was clearly a different sort of person. He had had a bad, I think, 24 hours before that time. And David started back into this facts and dates interrogation. And Nixon was clearly faltering. And one of his aides came onto the set and asked for a break. And David acquiesced in this. This is quite a controversial moment, actually. And there was a 10-minute interlude in which the chief of staff for Nixon said, "You've brought him to this extraordinary moment in his life. He really wants to confess, as it were. He really wants to be forthcoming, but you've got to back off in your inquisitional style here so that you can talk." And this is where David Frost, as the entertainer, really was at the peak of his game. He knew, indeed, he had to change from being the inquisitor to being, in effect, the father inquisitor and the father confessor, to sort of pull out of this man something that he really didn't want to do, which is to say, to acknowledge crime and then to go on to apologize. So there was a very specific moment here, I think, when Nixon knew he had lost, knew that there was no escape. And that, that, of course, was our strategy, to make it impossible for him not to acknowledge crime and not to come to grips with the implications of that criminality.
Would you like a crack at crafting questions for the current occupant of the White House?
I don't think he's as interesting as Nixon. You don't get a sense that this president is emotionally engaged with Iraq. The way Nixon was emotionally engaged and Johnson was emotionally engaged with Vietnam, for example. And in Nixon's case, I think this is where very well documented by historians now, that in the final year of Watergate, there was a real question as to whether he was all there. you know, that he was so under pressure and was being so maligned everywhere that he was, it was really a question of his mental stability. So he was emotionally involved, and therefore that was something very interesting to plumb. With Bush now, and my guess would be Bush forever, we're going to get the same platitudes that we're hearing about Iraq. And there's something rather strangely, I think, disengaged emotionally in Bush from the implications of this disaster that he's foisted on the country.
James Reston Jr.'s book, The Conviction of Richard Nixon, The Untold Story of the Frost-Nixon Interviews, is published by Harmony. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Hello. I have Dr. Kissinger for you now, sir.
Hello.
There you are, Dr. Kissinger.
Hello, Henry. Mr. Brad, where are you? In your office? Yeah. Want to come over here? He'll be.
Right, I'll come right.
Yeah.
That's President Nixon's secretary putting through a brief call from Henry Kissinger on July 29, 1971. It's just one of hundreds of unguarded moments captured by Richard Nixon's secret taping system, which recorded some of the many high points of his presidency, from the opening of China to the SALT arms treaty with the Soviets. But of course, that system also captured conversations which would wind up costing Mr. Nixon his job. In the Nixon tapes, Lou Nichter and Douglas Brinkley catalog 3,700 hours of conversations and provide crucial insights into the White House and Nixon the man. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I'm very pleased to welcome Lou Nichter to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
You provide some context before each section, but this book is really a series of transcripts. Why did you feel that that was the best way to depict the Nixon presidency?
I think it was important 40 years later to have a book of really primary sources, historical sources out there. This is not intended to be a book that's either for Nixon or against Nixon, but really a book that gets the material out there and lets readers come to their own conclusions.
It doesn't cover the whole presidency, just 71 to 72.
Yeah, the taping ran from February of 71 to July of 73. It's so big. So we said, well, where do you divide this up? So we're saving Watergate and 73 for another book, and then this is the focus of before the crisis in 71 and 72.
This is also before the Agnew scandal?
It is. That was the fall of 73, and the taping system was turned off by that point.
Hidden microphones in the Oval Office go all the way back to FDR, but you note that Nixon had LBJ's tape recording system dismantled when he came into office.
After he was elected, Nixon, in November 68, LBJ gave him a tour of the White House, and he showed him even under LBJ's mattress in his bed. And see, he's seeing all the wiring of LBJ's fairly sophisticated system at the time, and said, this is the kind of thing you want to have to the president-elect for your memoirs, for your own personal records one day. And ultimately, Nixon had the system dismantled. One wonders whether he thought Democrats could eavesdrop on his conversations. But then just 2 years later, February 71, not a particular time of significance, he not only brings the system back, but it's far more sophisticated than any prior presidential system. It's voice activated.
And it's everywhere, all throughout the White House, Camp David?
It starts small and gets bigger. It starts just the Oval Office, Nixon's office in the Executive Office Building. He likes it so much, in fact, he adds the Cabinet Room. He adds a series of telephones across the White House. He adds Camp David. So by the time the system's really firing on all cylinders, so to speak, in the summer of 72, some days we have virtually every waking moment of Nixon.
Although many of them are hard to understand, why is the taping system so poor? The best things are obviously the telephone calls.
Yeah, that one, the example you just played, it seems the larger the room, the microphone was, and the more people in the room, the more chances for interference. So phone tends to be the best. The worst is going to be the high ceilings in the Executive Office Building, or sometimes a cabinet room full of noisy congressmen.
And then also where people are seated.
Yes,
not everybody's seated near a microphone.
Because, of course, most of them didn't know there were microphones.
In fact, John Dean told me that almost everyone was unaware that they were being recorded, and at times Nixon forgot that he was being taped. Did you get that sense listening to some of these?
You do. You know, people over the years have said, well, surely Nixon knew he was being recorded and no one else did. He must have made statements for the record or pontificated at some point. But what you see on the tapes, actually, is that there are very few conversations about the taping system itself, and Nixon seems to forget that it's going on. There are a couple of occasions where he talks to his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman, one of the only people who knew of the taping system's existence, and they forget the places that it exists.
And the existence of the taping system was hidden from the public for a long time. Many people have wondered why Nixon didn't just simply destroy the tapes once he realized that they could hurt him.
And that was the advice that many had for him, is you should burn these tapes. Legally, then, the law was different. The president then had much more discretion on what was public, what was private. Sure, it would have been terrible PR for his presidency in the middle of the Watergate investigation to have destroyed them, but it might have saved his presidency.
You're right. Nixon believed himself a world leader of great geopolitical insight and military strategy like Churchill. He believed that in spite of Watergate that he would be vindicated by history?
I think the taping started because he had in mind one day writing this sort of multi-volume Churchillian memoir, as Churchill did for, say, World War II. And I think ultimately you have to assume that Nixon giving all advice to the contrary to keep his tapes. I mean, Al Haig was very forceful. You need to burn these tapes. You're creating more evidence. They'll be used against you. I think what I conclude is that Nixon took a gamble with history. He believed ultimately that his other achievements, like the opening in relations with China, would ultimately outlast his critics and the Watergate material on the tapes.
And many people consider Nixon's opening of China to be his greatest achievement. How much of the debate and final decision to pursue normalized relations with China is recorded on these tapes?
Quite a bit, and most of it appears here in the book for the first time. And there are a number of new revelations. One that comes to mind is we all heard the term ping pong diplomacy over the years, and here you actually have what that means, the origin for the term. And what you see is that the tapes reveal that Nixon and Kissinger don't deserve all of the credit for the opening to China, that it was in fact the Chinese who moved even more quickly toward that thaw in relations than even the Nixon White House was comfortable with.
We have a recording from April 13, 1971 of Nixon speaking with Peter G. Peterson about how to discuss the potential detente with China with the press. On the recording, Nixon is coaching him on what to leak. Let's take a little listen.
What really is going to count with the Soviet, Pete, is the fact. I mean, that ping-pong team is worrying them right up the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll let the fact break. I'm just giving you this as a little kind of that kind of backroom stuff that an editorial board loves to hear.
Mm-hmm.
See what I mean?
Right.
You can say, now this is good information. Now you can say, I would urge that you watch this in the future and that sort of thing.
Right.
See what I mean?
Did he tend to micromanage in that way?
I think the tapes have revealed that he micromanaged much more than we thought he did, and I think much more than we think most presidents do. He's getting pretty far into the weeds, especially on China, Vietnam, and the Soviet Union.
2 days after the conversation with Pete Peterson, Nixon and Kissinger spoke about the potential of a diplomatic breakthrough with China and how it might be perceived in the media. Let's take a listen to that.
Henry, you know, we don't realize, I think China more than Moscow is a goddamned nerve thing for these people. What do you think?
I don't know. Because it's so new.
Huh?
And of course there's...
And of course, let's face it, in the long run, it's so historic. You know, you stop to think of 800 million people where they're going to be. Jesus, this is a hell of a move.
So he's aware of the historic aspect of this. Perhaps that's what made it so attractive?
It was a paradigm shift in international affairs. I mean, China, we had had no formal contact with what we called mainland China or Red China for 25 years.
Well, I spoke to Henry Kissinger about this because he's written a book about it, and I asked him why we reached out to China. He said, well, because they were having this conflict with the Soviet Union. And I said, well, wouldn't it have been in the United States' best interest to have them fight it out? They were both seen as our enemies. And he looked at me like I was kind of stupid.
I think the potential there, you've got two nuclear powers, you know, the catastrophe that would have caused. I guess that must have been the reasoning. But at the same time, politically, you know, Nixon thought of himself, he was a great admirer of the British system of government and parliament. He thought that this was Britain in the 19th century. You take the weaker and you play them off against the stronger. And he thought he was doing that by using China as leverage against Russia.
My guest is Luke A. Nichter, who with Douglas Brinkley has written a book called The Nixon Tapes. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Kissinger shows up again and again in this book. What did the two men see in each other?
That's complicated. Kissinger shows up so much because, focusing on 71 and 72, foreign policy was largely the things that Nixon spent the most amount of time on. And, you know, Nixon was surrounded by many people professionally in the Oval Office and in other places that were recorded. But one does not get the sense from the conversations that Nixon was very close personally with Henry Kissinger.
And John Dean told me yesterday that he thought that Kissinger had a tendency to indulge some of the worst qualities of his boss, bring out the dark side.
I have thought a lot about this. And, you know, I think most of the aides that Nixon was surrounded by were 20-something, 30-something young people. They're full of energy. They have their life ahead, a career ahead. You're working for the President of the United States. But regardless of who that person is, you're going to have disagreements at some point. And so people ask me, didn't they go into the Oval Office and say, Mr. President, you're wrong about this. This is what we should be doing instead. And I like to think, in my own situation, you walk into the Oval Office, you're surrounded by the history of that room and the grandeur of that space, and any likelihood you would object to the president to his face just goes right out the window.
Did Nixon ever criticize Kissinger to others?
He criticized not just Kissinger, but a number of his close aides behind their backs. Kissinger was criticized for being Jewish and for running American foreign policy in the Middle East. You know, Nixon, Kissinger was an unusual aide because Nixon detested Harvard and detested East Coast intellectuals, as he called them. But here he has a prominent one on staff who then could sort of fawn all over Nixon. So it was a way of seeking their approval.
We have a clip from May 27, 1971 of Kissinger talking about the treatment of Jews in the Soviet Union. And it's really poor quality. I hesitate to play it, but maybe the listeners will get a sense of what's being said and then we can go over it.
Sure.
With all, you know, I'm Jewish myself, but who are we to complain about Soviet Jews? It's none of our business. If they complain, if they made a public protest to us for the treatment of Negroes, we'd be, you know, it's none of our business how they treat them.
I don't know if the audience heard that, but he's saying, well, with all, you know, I'm Jewish myself. Nixon laughs at that. But who are we to complain about Soviet Jews? It's none of our business. If they complain, if they made a public protest to us for the treatment of Negroes, we'd be, you know, it's none of our business how they treat their people.
Yeah, Kissinger and Nixon are famous for this sort of theory of international relations called realpolitik, and in a sense they've taken it to the furthest extreme that you can in some of these conversations. It's purely the pursuit of national interests, and what's a private affair for another country is none of our business. And of course, there was a correction when Jimmy Carter came in the office, a greater emphasis on human rights. But this is one of the aspects of Nixon foreign policy that's been most criticized.
This conversation was in connection to the opening of China's paving the way for the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty with the Soviets?
Yeah, this was in advance of we had two SALT treaties, as they became known, and then two START treaties Presidents Reagan and Bush continued on in the 1980s, which were really fundamental to ending the Cold War conflict with the Soviet Union. So we were at the very beginning of the process, and you get the play-by-play of how that was set up on these tapes.
Did the frankness of exchanges like the one we just heard surprise you at all?
They do. I mean, these are not very presidential sounding, these words. And certainly to 2014 ears, these are conversations we would describe as sexist, racist, bigoted, anti-Semitic, and really even out of bounds, even for Nixon's own time.
How did Nixon talk about the Soviets on the tapes?
The Soviets, he clearly respected the Chinese much more than the Soviets.
He thought Mao was better than, what was it, Khrushchev then, or Brezhnev?
Brezhnev by then. And in his museum out in Yorba Linda, California, he has a gallery where he has statues of all what he considered to be the great leaders leaders of the era, and a gallery of that type includes, controversially, Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai and several Soviet leaders, too.
Yesterday, as I said before, we spoke with John Dean, who's also published a book based on the Nixon transcripts, including many where he was taped. He described Nixon as obsessive about certain issues, especially Watergate. Is it your sense that Nixon had an obsessive-compulsive side?
It's hard to say. You know, as a historian, I leave some of that analysis to my friends in the psychology field and psychiatrics. But Nixon did have, and maybe we don't know how much different is Nixon than other presidents. Nixon happens to be the one we have the recordings for, after all. But he did have certain kind of hot-button issues that he spent a lot of time talking about, eventually Watergate. And, of course, Watergate is such a large subject. We're leaving that for a separate book to come. We're focusing on
And this is
that.
A pretty big book, as it is.
Well, and it started about 18 inches taller than that before the editing happened. But, you know, Watergate, of course, The Kennedys are another hot topic for Nixon. They were rivals. They came to Washington the same time. There's a variety of – this is not just a book that covers the serious policymaking. There's plenty of politics and gossip and things you might not expect, too.
But we also hear Nixon listening to classical music while he worked.
One of his favorite things to do, even in the height of a Washington summer in the humidity, was have an enormous fire in the fireplace, a roaring fire. You can hear it crackling sometimes on the tapes. And he would turn on Rachmaninoff especially and others. And he would pick
so
up...
So he liked Russians, he just didn't like the Soviets.
Yeah, not contemporary Soviets. And he would play this quite loudly. So he would have a phone call come in. You can't even hear the speakers because the music is so loud. He'd put the phone down. Oh, wait a second. I have to go turn this down. And so he did. It helped him to meditate, I think.
The public often thinks of the cartoon version of Nixon. Words that often come up to describe him are sweaty, swearing, painfully awkward, paranoid. Do the tapes bear any of those images out?
They do and they don't.
What about the cursing?
The cursing is there. I find that the Nixon cursing is really just some four-letter words. And LBJ was much better at the art of cursing than Nixon ever could have hoped to have been. One thing that struck me when I started working on the tapes was, you know, the Watergate material is really what we know 40 years later that's been published so extensively. But it's important to remember the Watergate material is about 5 to 7% of the tapes. So we have over time allowed this 5 to 7% become almost 100% of our view of Nixon. And this is certainly a book that's not for Nixon or against Nixon. We're putting the material out there and letting readers come to their own opinion. But I think like most presidencies, after a passage of time, things become less controversial. There is a very gradual process of adjustment that goes on with the history.
I'm speaking with Luke A. Nichter, who's Associate Professor of History at Texas A&M University, Central Texas. A noted expert on the Nixon tapes. He has collaborated with Douglas Brinkley, the celebrated historian at Rice University and author of numerous bestsellers, on a book called The Nixon Tapes. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Luke A. Nichter, who with Douglas Brinkley has written The Nixon Tapes, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Another surprising moment in the tape is that you published in this book, is Nixon saying that he believed that gay people were born that way. Did that surprise you?
That's one of those moments that you take your headphones off and you just have to make sure you heard it properly. There's a lot to read into that conversation. Clearly, he's more open-minded than any leader of either political party at the time. And certainly even more open-minded than some leaders in his political party today. But at the same time, he blames the downfall of civilizations, Romans, the Greeks, on gay people. So there's a lot to read into it.
He trashes Indira Gandhi in one of the conversations. Why?
He didn't like her personally, was the first reason, and also because Pakistan, India's longtime nemesis, was essential to opening relations with China, because to open relations with China, we had no direct contact. We had to pick a country that was friends with both, and by using Pakistan and siding with Pakistan, that means siding with China against India.
And that has led to, has had many repercussions ever since.
Ever since, yeah.
Does Nixon talk much about the social issues that were tearing the country apart on the tapes?
There were some. The tapes starting in 71, you know, it would be so great if we had had 69 and 70. You know, we had a period in 70. You had the White House ringed by buses bumper to bumper because there was a fear the anti-war protesters coming off the mall could breach the gates of the White House. And unfortunately, we don't have tapes for that. And we don't have tapes for Nixon's meeting with Elvis in December.
We do have a lot about the war in Vietnam. Nixon seems to be fixated on the idea of peace with honor. What do you think he meant, what that meant to him?
I think peace with honor is one of these political slogans. What peace with honor meant to him, and of course he ran in 68 with a promise for a secret plan to end the war, details of which he did not reveal during the campaign. I think to Nixon the phrase meant get the best peace terms possible. It meant secure the prompt release of our POWs and MIAs leave South Vietnam, Democratic South Vietnam, our ally, in a position to govern for as long as it possibly can.
It didn't work out that way. It
didn't work out at all. As soon as the agreement was written in January of 73, just as the ink was drying, it started to look pretty weak.
Was there any discussion about what's come to be known as the secret war in Laos?
There is a little bit in there. Some of that was in 70 and early 71. There's some Laos material just at the very beginning of when the taping system picks up. It's one of these issues like Cambodia from 70 the year before where, again, I wish the taping system had been running.
Were they concerned that the story might leak out?
It stayed secret for a period of time, and ultimately it did leak out and take the repercussions of Cambodia, for example, the shooting at Kent State. So things did get out, and it did turn ugly for the Nixon administration, but he was pretty well past that point by the time the taping system started.
He sometimes really lets his hair down. You have a quote, he says, "Bomb the goddamn North like it's never been bombed." He even talked about the possibility of using nuclear weapons. Do you think he was serious?
I don't think anyone thinks that was a serious threat, and certainly not at the very moment you're trying to improve relations with North Vietnam's neighbor, the Chinese. But I think this does a couple things here. This shows exactly why Nixon didn't care that he was being taped. These tapes, after all, are more damaging to him than anyone else. And I think secondly,
he thought nobody was going to hear them but him.
He never thought a book like this would be written. These were his personal property. The tapes were subpoenaed by Congress. Then when Congress was done with them after Watergate, they were transferred to the National Archives. And ever since, they've been coming out a drip at a time.
On the other hand, we learned a lot about what was going on with our foreign policy. And there's some really invaluable stuff here. The tapes cover Henry Kissinger's reports to Nixon about the state of peace talks in 1972.
Yeah, and I remember listening to the Vietnam conversations from 71 and 72. One of those moments that I had were, again, you have to just reflect on, while I don't think anyone has heard this, no one's published this before. In 72, of course, with hindsight, we say, well, Nixon was reelected in a landslide. Of course, Watergate was silly. But a year before in 71, it was not going well. His public approval ratings were low. It looked anything but that he would be elected in a landslide. And one of the things he discloses to Kissinger in one of the conversations here, and I'm not aware it's appeared anywhere else, Nixon was willing to resign or step down in 72. And you think
that's before Watergate was had ruined.
That was in 71. Exactly. This was before Watergate. He was willing to step down because it wasn't going well, and he thought it would be bad for the country. And what he says to Kissinger in the recording is, of course, today we say, well, how serious was that? Was he just running his mouth like he does on other occasions? We have to use 1972 thinking. Just 4 years before, Lyndon Johnson did just that, going on national television on March 31st, 68, saying he would not stand for reelection, would not accept the nomination of his party. And I think Nixon saying that if it would be better, he was willing to go away quietly. Vietnam already destroyed one presidency. He was not going to let it destroy two presidencies.
It's interesting that we see these contradictory sides of Nixon, the bombastic Nixon, and then the Nixon that at least is alleged to have not complained about the election against Kennedy because he felt that it would, if he protested, that it might destroy the country.
When you listen to the tapes, it's one thing to get a snippet here or a snippet there, but when you listen to, say, an entire day or an entire week, He's a very different person in the morning to a close aide than he is in the afternoon to a congressman he barely knows. He really is a prism, and you turn the prism just slightly, and the ray of light and color that it projects can be totally different.
I would assume that would be true for almost every president.
I think so.
You talk differently with your closest advisors, your friends, than you do with people who you're trying to get something from or trying to prevent getting something from you.
Certainly, Richard Nixon occupies sort of a unique place in American political history, in our national consciousness. But part of me wonders, is he really that different, or is he just the one that we have all these recordings of?
Well, perhaps he was more extreme in some ways. After all, he did engage in a number of things that we hope other presidents haven't engaged in.
He did.
There were a lot of dirty tricks, although he complained that LBJ did dirty tricks.
Chuck Colson one time told me the reason why Nixon and I were political soulmates was because we both believed in a knee-in-the-groin political philosophy. These were hardscrabble guys. Nixon grew up without very much. His parents were poor, and he believed in the fight, and when the fight ends, you end.
Well, John Dean said yesterday that he thought that Chuck Colson brought out the worst in Richard
Nixon. Ray Price, his longtime speechwriter, once said to me that the handful of us who spent the most time with Nixon in the Oval Office, we each had to have a filter on what Nixon said and what he asked us to do. And he said some of us had better filters than others.
My guest is Luke A. Nichter, who with Douglas Brinkley has written the Nixon tapes, which are the tapes as from when the tape system was installed until 1972, predates a whole bunch of important things. And the next book is going to come out.
We're trying to aim for later next year. There's another 2 feet pile of transcripts to edit. The editing is what takes the longest.
John Dean talked about how his going over transcripts, he was helped by the fact that he knew these people and they talked in distinctive ways. And some of the transcriptions that he had read of things that he worked on had been inaccurate because people didn't hear the words correctly.
The hardest part when I got started almost a decade ago was just learning the voices. I mean, Nixon has a very distinctive voice. Henry Kissinger has a very distinctive voice. But then you're faced with a problem like a cabinet room full of Southern congressmen, and they all sound like House Ways and Means Chairman Wilbur Mills. They all sound exactly the same. And those conversations are just there's a certain amount of this material that's just going to be indecipherable.
The tapes also cover Henry Kissinger's reports to Nixon about the state of peace talks in 1972. Now, what is your feeling there? Was Nixon leading Kissinger, giving him ideas, or was Kissinger pretty much leading Nixon?
I think the policy was clearly Nixon's policy. You know, there have been some debates over how much of it was Nixon, how much of it was Kissinger, how much was Kissinger just clearly carrying out the orders of Nixon. I look at it as though the policies were clearly Nixon's, and Nixon and Kissinger were just this sort of dynamic duo. The one needed the other, and Kissinger was sort of the perfect implementer, if you will, of Nixon's policies. But the genesis for the policies that the tapes show us are clearly Nixon's.
And what was he asking to be accomplished? I know peace with honor, whatever that means.
Well, there's an ebb and flow to peace with honor. Peace with honor might sound like something that's not very peaceful, like an increase in bombing in Hanoi or mining Haiphong Harbor. So frequently Kissinger is coming back. He's meeting in the North Vietnamese in Paris, or he's going to Saigon in South Vietnam. And he's coming back and he's saying, this is what they say, this is what we said. And they're kind of kicking around the latest set of negotiations, and he's getting his instructions from Nixon when he heads back.
And in the end, it works out that the United States caved in totally, despite the fact that we were using this carrot and stick approach.
I think the only thing that Nixon was insistent on that thankfully we got was the return of the POWs. But it was really the tragic war that just wouldn't end. I mean, Kissinger announced before the election in 72 that peace was at hand, only to find out that peace was not at hand. The agreement unraveled, and we had to make an agreement really over top of our ally, South Vietnam, have a terrible bombing, the Christmas bombing, Operation Linebacker 2, and then it took still a couple more months to get the Treaty of Paris.
You mentioned the subject of Kennedys coming up on these tapes, particularly Teddy Kennedy. Yesterday, in my conversation with John Dean, he said that Nixon offered to give Ted Kennedy Secret Service protection as a way of spying on him, and I wondered why Teddy wasn't even running against Nixon.
Nixon always thought that the real candidate on the Democratic side would emerge, and it would be Ted Kennedy. That it wouldn't be McGovern, it wouldn't be Humphrey, it wouldn't be Muskie, but it would be Ted Kennedy. He was the one who had the name value. He was the blockbuster candidate. And I think in hindsight, we think ultimately it was Chappaquiddick that probably kept Kennedy out in 72. And Nixon, one of the interesting things about the tapes is, to touch on the Secret Service issue, Nixon does suggest, because at the time, it's different now, but back then, candidates did not, unless you were an official candidate, prospective candidates did not have Secret Service protection. But he was a Kennedy. Kennedys were special. Both of his brothers had already been assassinated. And so Nixon suggested putting a couple of agents on him, but letting us choose the agents, he says. And so as a listener, you think, Did he do that? Did he follow up? What really happened? And we don't always know.
And Ted Kennedy turned down the offer.
He did. He didn't want it. He had his own security protection anyways.
You do address the famous 18 and a half minute gap on the tapes in this book, even though that took place in the purview of the second book.
We felt like this was not a book about Watergate, but you still have to mention those signposts about Watergate. So the 18-and-a-half-minute gap conversation on June 20th, 72 is the very first conversation that Nixon and Haldeman have following the break-in on June 17th.
You write that the way that Nixon starts the conversation suggests that perhaps the erased portion included some discussion of wiretap.
And this is new in this book. It hasn't appeared anywhere else. There's a phrase where Nixon says, and now getting back on wiretapping, the trouble is we have no portion about wiretapping, unless you're referring to something that was within the erased portion.
But he was wiretapping everybody. Wasn't that well known?
Well, that's what Nixon says in the conversation. He says, we do it to them, they do it to us. There's a mutual understanding.
Does he talk about the enemies list in any of these conversations?
No, he never referred to it as the enemies list, and that came later during Watergate.
One of the most notable exchanges on the tapes, which we can't play because the audio equipment is quite poor, is from June 23rd, 1972. And in it, Nixon discusses the Watergate scandal with H.R. Haldeman. He suggests that Haldeman ask the CIA to ask the FBI to back off its investigation because it could, and I'm quote, open the whole Bay of Pigs thing. People have often wondered what Nixon was talking about there. Do you have any theories?
There's still a lot we don't know about that. But what we do know is that Nixon always thought that, look, Nixon had been around in Washington since the late 1940s. He was vice president for 8 years, served in the House and the Senate, and as much as he benefited from the guidance of the CIA and the intelligence community, he understood or believed that there were a lot of skeletons in their closet, and he frequently threatened, as even more contemporary presidents do, to, while keep their own papers closed for a period of years, to open up the papers of his predecessors.
The most recent polls have Barack Obama the most underappreciated president since FDR. It was Richard Nixon for a long time. It's also been George W. Bush. Do you think that what we learn from these tapes will force us to reevaluate Nixon in a positive way, in a negative way? Or are we just going to wind up going horizontal with him?
I don't think that we can ever talk about Richard Nixon without talking about Watergate and abuses of power, you know, no matter if it's 100 years later. But at the same time, you know, Nixon doesn't have to be all good or all bad. You know, I think like most presidents, regardless of your political persuasion, there's the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I think we can give credit for what Nixon's do, and we can criticize what should be criticized.
And in many ways, as Tom Wicker has pointed out, he can be seen as the last of the real liberal presidents. Whatever he believed in, he still supported affirmative action, the Clean Air Act, the
EPA,
environmental protection, all these things that people in his party are now outraged by and trying to get rid of.
It's a different Republican Party today. Some people say, well, none of those things would have been passed without a Democratic Congress that was veto-proof. And it's a little bit like the argument during Clinton's presidency, how much of the balanced budget do you give the Republican Congress for? And like any issue, is it Congress, is it the president? It's really a combination of both. We do know that if Nixon didn't agree with those policies, he would have vetoed them.
Did he deal well with Congress?
Surprisingly, for someone who had served in the House and the Senate, he did not. And when he needed their support the most during Watergate, they weren't there for him.
Luke A. Nichter is associate professor of history at Texas A&M University, Central Texas. With Douglas Brinkley, he has written the Nixon tapes. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show today. It's just been fascinating. Will you come back with the second volume?
I certainly will. It's been my pleasure. Thanks a lot.